This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. This is the concluding lecture in the series, Lecture 8, given in Dornach on April 22, 1923. There are some additional items after this, some questions and answers, and I believe there's another small talk on Eurythmy. To round off what could be said only in a poor and sketchy outline during the last few days about education based on anthroposophical investigations, I should like to add something today about the way the Waldorf School is run, as an example of how these ideas can be put into practice. What has to emerge clearly out of the spirit of this education is that equal consideration be given to everything pertaining to the human body, the soul, and the spirit. If, therefore, the actual teaching is carried out in the way characterized, it will at the same time become a kind of hygiene in the life of the child, and if need be, even a therapy. In order to see this clearly, one has to be able to look at the being of the child in the right way. And here it must be understood that everything we had to say about the child's development from birth to the change of teeth is revealed, above all, in the activities of the nerve sense system. Every organic system naturally extends over the entire human body, but at the same time each system is localized in one definite part of the physical organization. And so the nervous system is chiefly organized in the head. But when speaking about the three main organic systems of the human being, namely the nerve sense system, the rhythmic system, and the metabolic motor system, we do not imply that they are confined only to the head, the chest, and the metabolic limb systems, for this would be wholly inaccurate. It is impossible to divide the human organization into three separate spatial regions. All one can say is that these three systems interpenetrate one another, and that they work and weave into each other everywhere. Nevertheless, the nerve sense system is localized mainly in the region of the head. The rhythmic system, which includes everything of a rhythmic nature in the human being, is chiefly organized in the chest organs, in the organs of breathing and blood circulation. Here one must not overlook the fact that everything that furthers the rhythms of digestion, and finally also those of sleeping and waking, belongs to the rhythmic system too, insofar as digesting and sleeping and waking have their physical foundation within the human organism. The actual chemical physiological process of digestion is intimately connected with all that forms the human motor system. As for movement itself, a reciprocal activation is going on between the nutritional and digestive system on the one hand and the actual physical movement on the other. All this means that although the three systems, of course, work into each other during the child's early years, up to the change of teeth, the formative and plastic molding forces involved in the child's growing and in the processes of nourishment work mainly downward from the head, the center of the senses and the nervous system. Consequently, if a young child falls ill, the illness is essentially due to the influences of the nerve sense system. This is the reason why young children, before their second dentition, are particularly liable to suffer from those illnesses that originate from within and that are called children's illnesses. The influences emanating from the surroundings, which reach the child via its urge for imitation, have a most powerful effect on this vulnerability to children's illnesses, more than is generally realized by the medical profession in the present materialistic climate. Thus a sudden outburst of anger on the part of an adult when witnessed by a young child can in many a case be held responsible for an attack of measles. Here I am not referring to the psychopathic outburst of a maniac, but to a less violent form of temper that can be so often seen among people. The ensuing shock, together with its moral and spiritual implications, must certainly be looked upon as a contributory cause for measles. Furthermore, all these influences, working upon the child, will remain as after effects until almost its ninth year. If it should happen that a teacher becomes very angry in school, for instance, if he or she reacts to a child's accidentally spilling some ink by shouting, quote, "If you do that again, I'll pour the entire inkwell over your head, or I'll throw it at your head," close quote. If such a thing should happen, then we must not be surprised if it has a very damaging effect upon the child's physical health. I have, of course, chosen a somewhat drastic example, but it is the kind of thing that can happen all too easily in a classroom. Inner untruths in teachers also have a very harmful effect upon the children, even beyond their second dentition. Untruths can take on many different guises, such as insincere or hypocritical piety, or laying down a moral code for the children which the adults would not dream of applying to themselves. In such cases, the element of untruth weaves and lives in the words spoken and in what is being unfolded in front of the child. An adult may remain totally oblivious to it, but a child will take it in through the teacher's gestures. Dishonesty and hypocrisy have an exceedingly powerful effect via the nerve sense system upon the organization of the child's digestive tract, and particularly so upon the development of the gallbladder, which subsequently can play a very significant part in the rest of the child's life. All pedagogical dealings have to be permeated by this intensive awareness of our spirit, soul, and body, constantly interweave and mutually affect each other, even though there is no need for teachers to talk about it all the time. And since during these early years the human organism is so active from the head downward, that is, from the polarity of the nerve sense system, and because abnormal conditions can so easily override so-called normal ones in the head region, the child is particularly vulnerable to children's diseases just at this age. The years between the change of teeth and puberty, strangely enough, and yet true to the nature of the human organism, are the child's healthiest years, though this is hardly surprising to anyone with insight into human development. The reason is that at this age the child's entire organization radiates out from the rhythmic system. This is the very system that never tires and never becomes overstimulated on its own account. Symptoms of illness occurring during these years are brought about by outer circumstances, though naturally this statement must not be taken too rigidly, and only in the context of actual life situations. A child who is subject to illness at this particular age, when the rhythmic system plays such a dominant part, cannot, in one way or another, have been treated properly in outer life. And when puberty is left behind, falling ill radiates outward from within, namely from the metabolic motor system. At that time of life, the causes of illness to which the young persons are exposed rise up from within, as the way of teaching the actual lessons is largely instrumental in what plays into the physical disposition of the pupils. We must always allow a certain physical and soul hygiene to be carried as if on wings by our educational ideas and methods. This must always be part of whatever we may be doing with our classes, particularly during the second period of childhood. Here one can point out some details. Let us take, for example, a child of a melancholic disposition. If you give it sugar, naturally in appropriate dosage, you will find that the sugar has a totally different effect from what happens in the case of a predominantly sanguine child. In a melancholic child, the sugar will have a suppressive effect upon the activity of the liver. It is this gradual lessening of liver activity that, in radiating out into the entire being of the child, has the effect of curbing the melancholic tendencies from the physical side. It is a useful expedient, but one has to know it. Using it as an aid does not mean denying soul and spirit. For whoever knows that in all physical or material processes spirit is working, as revealed in Anthroposophy, will not look upon the effect of an increased sugar intake on the activity of the liver as something merely physical, but as the working of soul and spirit brought about by physical means. Naturally, the result always depends on the correct dosage. In the case of a sanguine child, it can be beneficial to stimulate its liver activity by withholding sugar. This is one example of how knowledge of the interaction and mutual working together of body, soul, and spirit can be of great benefit to the three systems of the human being. It also surely allows one to say that, contrary to frequently held opinions, Waldorf pedagogy, which proceeds from spiritual foundations, definitely does not neglect the physical aspects of education. On the other hand, you will find that other forms of pedagogy, bent on developing the physical part of the child according to fixed and abstract rules, in actual fact serve at least because their adherents do not realize that every soul and spiritual stirring in the child has a direct effect upon its physical nature. Because of all this, I felt it necessary to give a seminar course before the opening of the Waldorf School for the benefit of those personalities who had been chosen to become its first teachers. One of the main aims of this course was to bring the fundamental and comprehensive thought of the working together of soul, body, and spirit into the new pedagogy before its actual launching. For the knowledge of it has been gradually lost during the 19th and 20th centuries, more so than is generally realized. During the years that followed the founding of the Waldorf School, shorter supplementary courses were also given. It goes without saying that anyone who seriously considers taking an active part in Waldorf education needs to live in the spirit of these courses. This is what really matters. If one wants to treat a certain content in a living way, the details are of lesser importance, for they can always be worked out of the spiritual background. And then the details will also appear in their proper perspective. You may already have seen from talks given by Waldorf teachers, such as Dr. von Baraval and Dr. von Heidebrandt, that the attempt was made to let the spirit living in this education flow into the ways in which various subjects were taught. Something akin to life blood will pulsate through the lessons when the human organization is conceived in terms of an all-comprising spiritual entity. Naturally, in this respect, much of what can be said today will have to remain brief and sketchy. Yesterday I already mentioned that a united college of teachers, functioning like the soul and spirit of the entire school organism, is absolutely fundamental to the running of a Waldorf school. In accordance with one of its pedagogical impulses, it is not so much a statistical collation of the teacher's observations expressed during the meetings which matters, but that a living and individualizing psychology should be jointly developed out of the actual experience of lessons taught. I would like to give you an example. In our school, boys and girls sit next to each other. When we started, there were just over 100 pupils in the Waldorf School, but our numbers have grown so rapidly that last year we had 700 pupils, and this necessitated opening parallel classes, especially in the lower part of the school. Now we find that in some classes there are more girls than boys, while in others there is a majority of boys over girls. Only in very few classes are the numbers of boys and girls more or less even. To insist on equal numbers in each class would not only be pedantic, but would also not work. First of all, new arrivals do not come neatly paired, and secondly, such a scheme would not represent an actual life situation. The right way forward in such a situation is to make it possible to apply one's educational impulses, whatever the outer circumstances may be. All the same, we soon found that a class with a majority of girls presented a very different psychological picture from one where there was a larger number of boys, and this quite apart from the outer circumstances, that is to say, from what was more obviously discernible. What gives such a class its psychological character is the imponderable element which so easily escapes one's notice. Nevertheless, when working together in our meetings, the possibility of making fruitful investigations in this direction was given, and it soon became clear that sharing such questions of common interest greatly contributed to the school's becoming a living and ensouled organism. Let us imagine a person who says, "I want to think only thoughts which will be useful to me in later life. I do not wish to allow anything to enter my soul which is not of direct value for later life, for this would be uneconomical." Such a person would become quite a dreadful figure in life, for first he or she would have nothing to dream about, in fact would never be able to dream. Of course, people who are inclined this way might easily reply, "Dreams are unimportant. One can well do without them, for they have no real meaning in life." True, dreams are of little consequence for those who accept only outer reality. But what if there were more to dreams than merely fantastic images? Naturally, the kind of people who believe they see something highly significant and deeply prophetic in every dream, even if it is only caused by their liver, gall, or stomach activities, people for whom dreams are more important than events in waking life, they will not draw any benefit from their dreaming. Yet if one knows that in one's dream life forces come to expression, even if only indistinctly, that have either a health-giving or an illness-inducing effect on the breathing, circulatory, and nerve sense systems, then one also knows that half of the human being is mirrored in these dreams, either in a hygienic or pathological sense. Moreover, one will recognize that not to dream at all would be similar to one's undermining the digestion or circulation through taking some form of poison. It is of importance to realize that in a human being, much of what might appear unnecessary for outer life nevertheless plays an important part, just as we find it in outer nature. Only compare the infinite number of herring eggs distributed all over the seas with the number of herring actually born, and you could easily reproach nature for being grossly wasteful. However, this can only be the opinion of people who do not know of the powerful spiritual effects the perished herring eggs have upon the growing herrings. So and so many eggs have to die so that so and so many eggs may thrive. These things are all interconnected. If we now relate this thought to the school as a living organism, we have the following situation. In the meetings of our College of Teachers, such matters as the proportion of boys to girls, and many other problems as well, are being worked through from a psychological and pneumatological aspect as part of a common study of soul and spirit. Efforts are continually made to bring about a new understanding of the psychological and pathological problems facing the school. And in order to cover every contingency, there is something else that is essential in the life of a school, something we have in the Waldorf School, and that is a school doctor. He is a full-time member of the staff, who also teaches various classes in the school. This enables the teachers, insofar as they take an active part in all the meetings, to discuss and work through pathological and therapeutic questions, as well as those posed by the specially gifted child. Problems are studied not only for the benefit of individual cases, more or less statistically, but they are worked through in depth. In this way, a great deal can be learned from each individual case, even if it does not always appear to be of immediate use. One could compare the situation with someone who has taken in something or other which he or she declares to be of no use in life. Nevertheless, life may prove it to be otherwise. In like manner, what is worked through by the teachers in these meetings, creating a living psychology, a living physiology, and so on, continues to have its effect, often in quite unexpected places. Imagine that you had occupied yourself, say, with the spiritual functions of a child's gall, forgive this expression, but it is fully justified, and that through this study you would learn to find your way into this kind of thinking. If you were now suddenly called upon to deal with a child's nose, you actually would relate quite differently to the new situation. Even if you may think, "What is the good of learning all about the gall if now I have to deal with the nose?" Once you have found a point of entry, you meet all problems and tasks in a different way. In this sense, the College of Teachers must become the spirit and soul of the entire school organism. Only then will each teacher enter the classroom with the right attitude and in the right soul condition. At the same time, we must also bear in mind that just in these matters an intensely religious element can be found. There is no need to have the name of the Lord constantly upon one's lips, nor of calling upon the name of Christ all the time. Better to adhere to the command, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord God in vain." Nevertheless, it is possible to permeate one's entire life with a fundamental religious impulse, with a most intensely Christian impulse. Then certain experiences of old, no longer known to modern intellectuality, will begin to stir in one's soul. They are experiences that are deeply rooted in human evolution, in the Christian development of humankind. For instance, teachers who in the depths of their souls are seeking the right stimulation for finding the appropriate forms of pedagogy, especially in these pathological, physiological areas, would do well to let themselves be inspired, time and again, by what radiates from the Gospel of St. Luke. To modern ears, such a statement must sound grotesque. On the other hand, teachers who wish to instill in their pupils the necessary idealism for life would do well to find a source of inspiration by reading again and again in the Gospel of St. John. If teachers do not want their pupils to grow up into cowards, but into the kind of people who will tackle life's tasks with ebullient energy, they should look for inspiration in the Gospel of St. Mark. And those who are keen on educating the young to grow into perceptive adults rather than into people who go through life with unseeing eyes may find the necessary stimulation in the Gospel of St. Matthew. These are the qualities which in olden times were felt to live in the different Gospels. If our contemporaries were to read that in the past ages the Gospel of St. Luke was felt to radiate a healing element in a medical sense, they would be unable to make anything of it. On the other hand, if they entered life as real pedagogues, they would begin to understand such matters again. This is one way in which one can speak about these things. It is equally possible to speak about them in an entirely different way, no less religious or Christian. For instance, the main theme during a seminar course could well be the four temperaments of the human being, namely the psychic, physical, and spiritual natures of the choleric, melancholic, sanguine, and phlegmatic temperaments. First, one would give a description of these four temperaments, and then one could discuss how they must be treated in class. For instance, it has a salutary effect if one seats choleric children together in one corner of the classroom, in this way giving a certain relief to the rest of the class, because the teacher is freed from having to constantly discipline them. Choleric children can't help pushing and hitting each other. If they now find themselves suddenly at the receiving end, this in itself produces a thoroughly pedagogical effect, because the ones who do the pushing and shoving, goading others into retaliating, are being licked into shape in a very direct way. And if by seating the phlegmatics together one lets them phlegmatize each other, this too has a wonderfully pedagogical effect. However, all this needs to be done with the necessary tact. One really has to know how to handle the situation in each individual case. You will find a detailed treatment of the children's various temperaments in the published version of the first training course given to the teachers of the Waldorf School. What I have said about the four Gospels, fundamentally speaking, is exactly the same thing when seen from a spiritual point of view, because it leads one into the same element of life. Today it is generally felt that if one wants to learn something, the relevant elements have to be put neatly side by side. But this is a procedure that will not lead to fundamental principles as they have to be dealt with in actual life. For instance, one cannot understand the human gall or liver system unless one also has an understanding of the human head, because every organ in the digestive tract has a complementary organ in the brain. One does not know anything about the liver unless one also knows its correlative function in the brain. Likewise, one does not have an inner understanding of the immense inspiration that can flow into the human soul from the Gospels unless one is also able to transpose these into the ways in which character and temperament are imprinted into the human individuality here on earth. To grasp the world in a living way is something significantly different from grasping it by means of dead concepts. This will also lead one to see that if one brings up children in the light of the education spoken of here, one allows something to grow up in them that will outlast their childhood days, something that will continue to have an effect throughout their lives. For what is it you have to do when you grow old? People who do not understand human nature are incapable of judging how important certain impulses, which can be implanted only during childhood, are for life. At that tender age, it is still possible for these impulses to be immersed into the soft and pliable organism of the child, still so open to the musical formative forces. In later years, the organism becomes harder, not necessarily physically, but at any rate tending toward psycho-bodily sclerosis. However, what one has absorbed through one's upbringing and education does not grow old. However old one may have become, one is still inwardly endowed with the same youthful element that was one's own from, say, the 10th to the 15th year. This element of youthfulness one always carries within. But it has to remain so supple and flexible that the now aged brain, perhaps already covered by a bald head, is capable of using it in the same way in which the formerly soft brain did. However, if a person's education has not aided this process, the result is the generation gap, which so often makes its appearance these days and which is considered unbridgeable. People sometimes say something that in reality is the opposite of what is actually happening. For instance, one often hears the remark, "Today the young do not understand the old, because old people no longer know how to be young with the young." But this does not represent the truth, not at all. What is really happening is that the young generation expects the old generation to be able to make the right use of the physical organization which has grown old. In this, the young recognize something in the old that is different from their own condition, something that is not yet theirs. It is this quality that leads to the natural respect for old age. When young people meet an old person who is still capable of using an already bald head in the way a child used its tousled head, they feel that they can receive something from the old generation, something that they cannot find in their contemporaries. This is how it ought to be. We must educate the young so that they know how to grow old in the right way. It is the malaise of our times that the young, as they grow up, do not recognize in members of the old generation people who have aged rightly. Instead, they see in them merely childish individuals who have remained at the same level of development as the young generation. Because, due to their inadequate education, old people are unable to make proper use of their physical organization, they remain infantile. The expression "big kids" is really chosen with great ingenuity, for it implies that such persons lost the ability to get hold of their entire organism during the course of their lives. They can work only with the head, which is precisely what children or youngsters are meant to do. So the young respond by saying, "Why should we learn from them? They have progressed no further than we have. They are just as childish as we are." The point is not that old age is lacking in youthfulness, but that it has remained behind at too infantile a stage, and this is what causes the difficulties today. You see how sometimes expressions chosen with the best of will have the opposite meaning of what they are supposed to convey. All these things must be seen in their proper light before education can be put back on its feet again. This has become more than necessary today. Forgive this somewhat drastic way of seeing it, but in our intellectual age, education really has been turned upside down. And so one of the characteristic features of Waldorf pedagogy is to learn that it is not the externals that matter. Whether a teacher draws substance for the pupil's soul nourishment from the individually different qualities of the four Gospels, or whether this is achieved by making use of what was presented in the Stuttgart Teacher's Training Course with regard to the four temperaments, does not matter at all. What does matter is the spirit that reigns in all that was developed there. Because of the superficial ways in which these things are so often taken today, it could easily happen that Someone, on being told that the treatment of the four temperaments could be studied in the fundamental course given in Stuttgart, also consults a later course in which she or he finds something about the teacher's attitude toward the four Gospels. The reaction of such a person might well be, in this case, I ought to study the later course as well. It certainly is a good thing to approach different subjects by using different sources, but there is also another way of looking at it, namely that one may find a common message running through both courses, given in two different places at different times, even if outwardly their content may appear to differ widely. These inner concordances found in different lecture courses can be uncomfortable because of the way in which their various points are interlinked, instead of fitting into the more conventional patterns of cause and effect. And so you can take the educational course given here at the Goetheanum a little more than a year ago, at which a number of English friends were present, and which was rendered so ably and artistically by Herr Steffen, and compare it with what I have presented to you again in this course, in a different way. You will find that basically the substance of both courses is the same as, for instance, the head and the stomach, each form part of one and the same organism. What may be uncomfortable is that because of the way in which the various themes mutually support each other, one cannot say to oneself, I have read and understood the first course, and since the later one is supposed to carry the same message, there is no need for me to study that one as well. The fact is that if one has studied both courses, one will understand the earlier one in greater depth, because they each throw light upon the other. One could even say that only if one has digested a later teacher's course can one fully understand an earlier one, because of these reciprocal effects. Mathematics is built upon purely causal sequences. There it is possible to understand earlier stages without any knowledge of subsequent stages. But when it comes to a living pedagogy, its content is affected by mutual interconnections, with the result that what was given at an earlier date may receive further elucidation by what was presented later. I have mentioned this because it is all part of the living spirit which has to pervade Waldorf pedagogy. One has to have the goodwill to want to know it from all sides, and one must never be satisfied with having grasped one particular aspect of it. As a Waldorf teacher, one has to be conscious of having to widen and deepen one's knowledge more and more, instead of feeling satisfied with one's achievements, thinking that one is, after all, quite a clever fellow. If one has lived oneself into Waldorf pedagogy, one will soon get over such delusions. For a true Waldorf teacher, everything that flows from it has to be imbued with true heart and soul forces. It has to spring from the right kind of self-confidence, which rests upon one's trust in God. If one is aware of the divine forces working within, one will be fed by an ever-flowing fount of life, flowing since time immemorial, quite apart from what one may or may not have learned outwardly. One is only at the beginning of the way if one's self-confidence stems from outer achievements. One is where one ought to be when self-confidence has led to confidence in the working of God, when it has led to the awareness of the power of the words, not I, but the Christ in me. But when this happens, self-confidence becomes at the same time self-modesty, because one knows that divinely Christian forces are reflected in what is carried in one's soul. It is this spirit that has to reign throughout the school. If it were lacking, the school would be like an organism in outer nature from which life blood was being drawn or which was being slowly asphyxiated. It is this spirit which matters above all, and if it is alive, it will engender enthusiasm, irrespective of the personnel or the leadership of the school. And then one can also have confidence that something of an objective spirit will live throughout the school, which is not the same as the accumulation of each teacher's individual spirit. This, however, can be nurtured only gradually within the life of the College of Teachers. Out of work along these lines, something has emerged in the Waldorf School that we call block periods or main lessons. These main lessons, which are much longer than ordinary lessons, thus allowing one subject to be studied in depth, avoid the distraction caused in many children by too many changes of subjects. For instance, pupils might ordinarily be given a geography lesson from 8 to 8:45 a.m., followed by an entirely different subject, such as Latin, from 8:45 to 9:30 a.m. This again might be followed by math or some other lesson. Block periods of main lessons, on the other hand, are structured in such a way that one and the same subject is taught every day for some 3 or 4 weeks, depending on the type of subject, during the first half of the morning session. For instance, in a main lesson period, geography would be studied for some 3 to 4 weeks, not in a severe or heavy-handed manner, but in a more relaxed yet absolutely serious way. When the same subject is taken up again during one of the following terms, the new content will be built upon what was given during the previous block period. In this way, the subject matter to be covered in 1 year is taught in block periods, instead of in regularly recurring weekly lessons. This method is undoubtedly more taxing for the teachers than conventional schedule arrangements, because such lengthy geography lessons could easily become boring for the children. The solution lies in the teachers immersing themselves far more deeply in the subjects in order to measure up to their freely chosen tasks. After a mid-morning break, which is essential for the children, the main lesson is usually followed by language lessons, or by other subjects not taught in main lesson periods. 2 foreign languages are introduced to our pupils as soon as they enter the Waldorf School, in Class 1. Using our own methods, we teach them French and English, the aim being not so much a widening of their outer horizons, but an enrichment of their soul life. As you will gather from what was said yesterday, physical movement practiced above all in eurythmy and gym lessons is by no means considered to be of secondary importance, but is dealt with in such a way that it can play its proper part within the totality of the curriculum. Likewise, right from the beginning in Class 1, all lessons are permeated by a musical element in accordance with the various ages and stages. I have already indicated, unfortunately with enforced brevity, how our pupils are being led into artistic activities, into singing, music-making, modeling, and so on. Nurturing these activities is an absolute necessity. Purely by practicing them with the children, one will come to realize just what it means for their entire lives to be guided musically in the right way during these younger years, from the change of teeth through the 9th and the 12th years, up to puberty. The right introduction into the musical element is fundamental to a human being's overcoming all the hindrances that impede a sound and courage-imbued development of the will in later life. The musical forces have the effect upon the human organism of allowing the nerve fluctuations to work into the breath stream in the smoothest possible way. The latter, in turn, works back upon the functions of the nervous system. The breathing rhythms then work over into the rhythms of the blood circulation, which act upon the rhythms of sleeping and waking. This insight, afforded by anthroposophical investigation, of how musical forces are creatively working within the human organization, is one of the most wonderful things in life. One learns to recognize that in the raying out of the nerves from the spinal marrow, from the entire system of the spinal cord, we have an extremely sensitive and refined musical instrument. One also learns to see how this delicate instrument dries up and hardens, making the human being inwardly incapable of properly developing qualities of courage, if musical instruction and the general musical education do not work in harmony with this wonderfully fine musical instrument. What is coming into being through the mutual interplay between the organs of the nerves and senses with their functions on the one hand, and the human motor functions with their close affinities to the digestive rhythms and those of sleeping and waking on the other, all this constitutes a truly delicate and unique musical instrument. The upper part of the human being wants to play upon the lower part. By directing the child's entire organism toward the realm of music, we enhance the merging of external sounds coming from a piano during music lessons or from the children's singing voices with the nervous and circulatory systems in what can be recognized to be a divine plan of creation. This is something most sublime. For in every music lesson there is a meeting of the divine spiritual with what is coming from the earthly realm, rising up, as it were, in the child's body. In all that has been achieved in musical culture throughout human evolution on earth, heaven and earth are truly meeting, and of this we should always be aware. This awareness, plus the teacher's knowledge that they are instrumental in bringing together the genius of heaven with the genius of the earth, gives them the enthusiasm they need when facing their classes. It is this same enthusiasm that also carry into the college and teacher meetings, where the music teacher may inspire the art teacher, and so on. Here you can see clearly how essential it is for the spirit to work through every aspect of Waldorf education. To give another example, not long ago, during one of our teacher meetings, it really became possible to work out to a high degree what happens to the pupil's spirit, soul, and body when they are first given eurythmy exercises and are then led over into doing gym exercises. Such insight into the relationship between gymnastics and eurythmy, so important for the way in which these lessons are given, was really achieved in one of our teacher meetings the other day. Naturally, we shall continue with our research. This is how teacher meetings become like the blood that has to flow through the living organism, quote-unquote, school. Everything else will fall into place as long as one allows it to happen. Then teachers will also know when it is right to take their classes for a walk or on an outing, and the role of gymnastics will find its natural and appropriate place within the life of the pupils, whichever school they may be attending. Doubts and anxieties will disappear with regard to the remark, quote, "What is done in the Waldorf school may all be quite excellent, but sports are neglected there," close quote. Admittedly, it is not yet possible for us to do everything that may be desirable, because the Waldorf school had to develop from small beginnings. To have gone as far as we are today was possible only by overcoming enormous obstacles and external difficulties. But if matters are dealt with out of spiritual insight, this whole question of the relationship between the physical and the spiritual will be handled in the right way. One could use the following analogy. Just as there is no need for us to learn how the various larger and smaller muscles of the arm are functioning, according to the laws of dynamics and statics, of vitalism and so on, in order to be able to lift it, just as little do we have to know, in every detail, the ins and outs of all that has to be done, as long as we are able to approach and give the lessons out of the spirit which has become transmuted into the rightful attitude of the teacher, as long as we are able to penetrate to the very core of all our tasks and duties in the right way. I could only give you brief and sketchy outlines of the fundamental principles and impulses flowing from anthroposophical research, according to which the Waldorf School is run. And so we have come to the end of this course, mainly due to your other commitments. And at this point, I would like to express once more what I already said during one of our discussions. If one lives with heart and soul, with the ideal of letting education grow into a blessing for all humankind in its evolution, one is filled with deep gratitude on meeting teachers from so many different places. For you have come to this course in order to obtain information about the pedagogy springing from anthroposophical investigation, which I have attempted to put before you. Above and beyond whether this was received by one or the other participant with greater or lesser sympathy, I wish to express my deep gratitude and inner satisfaction that once more it was possible for a whole number of souls to perceive what is intended to work upon the most varied branches of life, and what is meant to fructify life in general through anthroposophy. Two thoughts will remain with you, especially with those who dealt with the organization and practical arrangements of this course: the happy memory of the gratitude, and the happy memory of the inner satisfaction, as I expressed it just now. And the more intensely these thoughts can be inwardly formed, the thoughts of the work that is grounded upon such gratitude and satisfaction, the more hope will grow that in times to come this pedagogy may yet succeed for the benefit of all humankind. Such hope will intensify the loving care for this pedagogy in those who already have the will to devote themselves to it with all their humanity. It also needs to be said that it was not only the Waldorf teachers who may have given you something out of their practical experience, for you who have been present here as visitors have certainly given to them in equal measure, by allowing us to witness that what lives in us is beginning to live in other souls as well. You have fanned the glow of love that is both necessary and natural, and that alone can engender genuine enthusiasm. And we may hope that out of the feelings of gratitude and inner satisfaction, of hope and love that have flowed together during this course, good fruits may ripen, provided we can keep up the necessary interest in these matters, and that we are inwardly active enough to keep them alive. Ladies and gentlemen, my dear friends, this is what I wish to pour into my farewell greetings. They are not to be taken as formal or abstract greetings, but as very concrete ones, in which gratitude becomes a firm foundation and inner satisfaction a source of warmth. Greetings from which hope will radiate out, bringing both courage and strength. May the love of putting into practice what is willed to become pedagogy for all fellow human beings be turned into light that shines for those who feel it their duty to care for the education of all humankind. In this sense, having to bring this course to its conclusion, I wish to give you all my warmest farewell greetings. The end of Lecture 8.